Washington, D.C. On this 17th day of February, 1801, the members of the House are about to try again to elect a President of the United States. Soon they will take the 36th ballot and hope this time to break the six-day deadlock between Jefferson and Aaron Burr. Jefferson is still one state short of the required nine-state majority, and unless he's elected on this 36th ballot, the events of the past few days indicate that violence and bloodshed will descend on this infant capital. The 16 tellers appointed by the Speaker of the House will poll their states. Then they will drop the votes in the two ballot boxes provided by the sergeant-at-arms. The votes
Washington, reported to February 17th, 1801, the Federal House of Representatives. You are there.
CBS takes you back 147 years. It is less than a generation since the end of the revolution which established the United States of America. Now the young republic faces the threat of another revolution arising out of a deadlocked presidential election. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. When CBS is there...
You are there.
You Are There is produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyon. And Walter Hamden plays Thomas Jefferson in today's broadcast. You Are There is based on authentic historical fact and quotation. And now...
1801, the gallery of the House of Representatives and John Daly.
This dramatic deadlock has come about in spite of the fact that Jefferson received the majority of the popular vote. A group of willful men in the Federalist Party, losers in the popular vote, are still trying desperately to block the people's choice. A tie in the Electoral College through this election into the House of Representatives, and here the Federalists are still hoping to elect Aaron Burr when he was meant to be Jefferson's running mate on the successful Democratic-Republican ticket. They think of Aaron Burr a lesser evil than Thomas Jefferson. And now, on Jefferson's supporters who are preparing to march on Washington. Virginia, Jefferson's home state, is probably the strongest center of pro-Jefferson feeling, so we take you now to Richmond, Virginia. Jack Walters reporting.
I'm in the executive office of Governor James Monroe. The roll of drums and the bugle you can hear are coming from the great courtyard below. The Virginia militia has been assembling down there since early this morning. I'd guess that there are about 1,000 men here, fully outfitted for a long march. Governor Monroe is here at our microphone. Governor, when will the Virginia militia march on Washington?
Upon my orders, Mr. Walter.
And can you tell me, Governor, when you will give your marching orders?
If the Federalist Party continues to plot treason, we are ready to put it down. If the political knaves of the Federalist Party succeed in their nefarious plot to elect Aaron Burr over Jefferson, we shall avenge this violation of the people's will. I've been in touch with Governor McKean of Pennsylvania. His militia, too, is fully armed and ready. We are prepared to march troops instantly upon the Capitol for the purpose not of promoting, but of preventing revolution and the shedding of a single drop of blood.
But, Governor, there are rumors that some 1,500 Democrats from Virginia and Maryland threaten to assassinate anyone who takes the presidency other than Thomas Jefferson.
This is a wild story, Mr. Walters, published no doubt by the same inflammatory Federalist paper that accused Mr. Jefferson of the Sabbath massacre of 2 million people, among them women, children, and 24,000 priests. A slight exaggeration. The Federalists, bigwigs, must learn that they cannot frighten the American citizen. They should have learned it when the people abolished the Federalist-inspired alien and sedition law. Their plots against the people did not work then, and they will not work now.
Well, thank you, Governor Monroe. New York City is another stronghold of Jeffersonian supporters. We take you there now. Arthur Hannes reporting. Go ahead, Hannes.
I'm in the headquarters of the Sons of Tammany. The members of this so-called ancient order here in Manhattan are gathering in this somewhat ancient building to march on Washington. The men crowding this building, which they call the Wigwam, wear Indian costumes and long, colorful feathers. There are men from the ordinary walks of life, the tradesmen, mechanics, and carpenters, the builders of this growing city. Here beside me is a man who calls himself an independent carpenter, and he's a fiery speaker who just a few moments ago made a speech calling for a march on Washington. His name is Timothy Ryan. Mr. Ryan, will you tell us, does Mr. Burr know that you make speeches against him?
I care not a tinker's damn for the opinion of Aaron Burr. He's deceived us like a Judas.
Well, Mr. Ryan, can you tell us where Mr. Burr is now?
As long as I have been a member of the Sons of Tammany, I have never seen Aaron Burr step foot in the wigwam. He works through his leaders. We will not sully himself to congregate in our midst. Right now, I hear tell that he's hiding in Albany, 100 miles away. And well, he might be to escape our wrath. We should not only march on Washington to put down the traitors, we should also march on Albany and put away Aaron Burr.
Mr. Ryan, our reports tell us that Mr. Burr is in Albany because his daughter is being married there. You tell me, as a loyal son of Tammany, Mr. Ryan, did you not yourself vote for Aaron Burr?
I did. God help me. But I meant him for vice president, as all the voters did. It is Jefferson that we elected for president, and well does Burr know it. We were told to write two names on our ballot, and we wrote Jefferson and Burr. And we were not told to designate who for president, who for vice president. Any fool knew if he was honest.
But Burr has also done nothing to take the first place away from Mr. Jefferson.
But he's done nothing to give it to him either.
Now, Mr. Ryan, in any case, according to the Constitution, the House must now make the final choice. That's the law. And you men, aren't you defying the law by your march on Washington?
Oh, defying the law, are we? Well, then I say we shall change the law. Change the Constitution. But let not the people be deprived of justice and cheated of the man they voted for. Thanks be to the Lord that we defeated the Federalist Tories by a great majority. But if Burr is elected by the insidious plot of a band of apostates, I say, in vain have we fought for liberty. In vain have we fought the British misrule. I say, avaunt oppressors, on to Washington. We have declared we'll be free, and neither bullying or coach will deprive us of our natural rights.
Thank
you. On to Washington.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ryan.
Right.
While we've been reporting from here in New York, we've had word that Ken Roberts in the Capitol has succeeded in arranging an interview with Alexander Hamilton. So back to Washington and Ken Roberts.
I'm in the library of the home of Mr. Josiah Quincy, Federalist Whip. Alexander Hamilton is waiting to meet Congressman James Bayard here. And while waiting, he consented to an interview. He has, however, stepped into the drawing room at the moment. In spite of the tensions and threats of violence that are shaking the few buildings in this capital, Washington society has not abandoned its social life. Right now, there's a party going on in this splendid mansion in the wilderness. The music is coming from the drawing room. Mrs. Josiah Quincy, our hostess, is here beside me, and she has offered to tell us a little about her prominent guests. Are they all Federalists, Mrs. Quincy?
Oh, no, indeed, Mr. Roberts. Even a member of Mr. Jefferson's party can find a haven of refuge here from the torture of the miserable boarding houses in Washington.
Even Mr. Jefferson himself?
Oh, good grief, no.
Perhaps he would enjoy the excellent company here, and your wonderful canvas-back duck.
Indeed, he'd be welcome. But I suspect that Mr. Jefferson would prefer to be surrounded by, oh, shall we say, more loyal admirers at Conrad's boarding house where he resides. Moreover, I doubt that he's given to the singing of psalms. To be sure, even an atheist may love to sing psalms, but certainly not in close harmony with Federalists.
Mr. Jefferson and his minister would deny he is an atheist.
Oh, if you'll forgive me a moment, I'll close the door.
Certainly. There are many notables gracing this home today. Mr. Robert Fulton, the inventor, is in the far corner of this library. Mr. Fulton is trying to raise capital for a new invention of his, a missile that can be fired underwater from a submarine vessel. Well, Mrs. Quincy has shut the library door, and Gouverneur Morris, the senator from New York, has come into the library with her. They're chatting now, and in a moment, Mrs. Quincy should be with us again. Right now, I can see Robert Fulton thumbing through a volume of Shakespeare. The English playwright is quite a favorite in this library. As a matter of fact, anything English is preferred in the home of a Federalist. Mrs. Quincy told me a blue ribbon evening was passed here last night when the senator from Kentucky read The Merry Wives of Windsor and the first act of Hamlet to the ladies. Oh, thank you.
Meanwhile, I brought you Gouverneur Morris, but you mustn't ask him any questions about politics.
Thank you, Mrs. Quincy. And thank you, Senator Morris. Do you think, Senator, that Mr. Hamilton will persuade Bayard of Delaware to break the deadlock today by voting for Jefferson?
Oh, now, please, no embarrassing questions. Senator Morris has just ended a very weary and dangerous trip from New York. Ask the Senator how he likes Washington.
Senator, how do you like Washington?
Washington's fine. I almost got lost in the woods through Maryland, but Washington's fine. We only need here houses, cellars, kitchens, scholarly men, amiable women. You, of course, my dear Mrs. Quincy, are the exquisite exception.
Thank you, Senator Morris.
And a few more trifles are needed here to possess a perfect city. In a word, this is the best city in the world to live in the future.
We hope so, Senator. But as you know, there are threats of destruction of this capital by armed militia from Virginia and Pennsylvania if Jefferson is not chosen today. Do you think Hamilton will save the capital today by saying...
You promised no questions on politics, Mr. Roberts, and I see that you're leading to a question on Hamilton again.
My dear, Washington is drunk with politics. The Federalists are like drunken men in their hatred for Jefferson. They believe that Jefferson's ideas on government are ideas of the rabble of revolutionary France. But Mr. Hamilton, alone among the Federalists, has remained sober. He believes, and I agree with him, that if the people want Jefferson, they must have him. A government must be fitted to a nation as a coat to an individual.
Thank you, Senator Gouverneur Morris. Now, the door of the library has just been opened, and Mr. Hamilton has come in. He's coming toward our microphone. Mr. Hamilton,
sir?
Is it true that you are trying to persuade Mr. Bayard to cast his vote against Aaron Burr on the 36th ballot?
It is true that I am against the Catiline of America becoming, in fact, the man of our party. Mr. Burr is far more cunning than wise, far more dexterous than able. If Mr. Burr acts ill, we must share in the blame and disgrace.
But, Mr. Hamilton, if your pressure to defeat Burr is effective, won't you then, in fact, be electing your greatest enemy, Thomas Jefferson?
Mr. Jefferson's ideas of democracy are a danger to our country. And the prospects of our country under the evil of foreign democratic doctrines and French Jacobism are far from brilliant. The mass of the people are far from sound. Democracy is the most visionary theory. Democracy is a disease, the poison of which is most virulent.
Mr. Hamilton, to what specific ideas in the platform of Jefferson are you opposed?
Mr. Jefferson would have a government with no army, no navy. A national defense not by arms, but by embargoes, and as little government as possible from within. These are the pernicious dreams which put our country on the steep descent to ruin.
But if you are opposed to the democracy of Mr. Jefferson and opposed to the politics of Mr. Burr, how are you urging Mr. Bayard to vote?
That will be for Mr. Bayard to decide. But for heaven's sake, let not the Federalist Party be responsible for the elevation of Burr. There is a man in the world I ought to despise. It is Jefferson. But the public good must be paramount to every private consideration.
I'm afraid I have to take Mr. Hamilton away now, Mr. Roberts. Congressman Baird has arrived.
Of course. Thank you, Mr. Hamilton.
Not at all.
This is Ken Roberts. I return you now to John Daly in the House of Representatives.
In this committee room of the House of Representatives lies Congressman Joseph H. Nicholson of Maryland. He is the representative referred to earlier by the Speaker of the House as the man who is risking his life here. Congressman Nicholson has just come out of a coma, the result of a raging fever, which has not abated for 6 days, ever since he was carried through the blinding snowstorm of last Wednesday. Somehow, as if by a miracle, this dying man gathers his strength to inscribe the name Thomas Jefferson on a slip of paper placed in his hands by his wife. Mrs. Nicholson has just guided his feeble hand as he wrote the name for the 36th time on the forthcoming 36th ballot. Mrs. Nicholson is kneeling beside her husband's bed, supporting his head on her arms. Gently, she lays his head back on the pillow and turns now to our microphone. Mrs. Nicholson, there are some who say that by awakening your husband in his condition to vote, you take upon yourself a dread responsibility.
It is my husband's fervent plea. My wish, too. For we are both faced with a more dreadful responsibility than the life of a single patriot. We're faced with the lives, the fortunes, and the sacred honor of a whole people. Of some, I know I must ask pardon for quoting the Declaration of Independence. For there are men among us who seek to bury alive this child of freedom, though it is but a score and 5 years old.
But in this room, ma'am, there are many Federalists who have come out of respect and admiration for the patriotism and the courage of you and your husband.
Oh, yes. It is the custom of conspirators to pay homage in the manner that the senators of Rome paid homage to Caesar. I have heard that a certain Federalist fears that my husband takes his life in his hands by his determination to remain here for the final vote, and that this Federalist would not thus expose himself for any president on earth. To this summer soldier, I say, do not fear for your life, for you are already dead. The Federalist Party has been pronounced dead by the popular vote of the people.
Mrs. Nicholson, I hope that your husband need risk his life no longer and that the Congress elects a president on this 36th ballot. And now, if you'll excuse me, Ned Kalmer reports a heated quarrel in the corridor downstairs. Go ahead, Ned Kalmer.
Matthew Lyons, Democratic congressman from Vermont, one of the two states whose vote is divided, has just accused John Brown, the Federalist congressman from Rhode Island, of attempting to bribe him into voting for Burr. Only the intervention of cooler heads kept them from coming to blows. They've calmed down a little now, but Congressman Lyons says he's willing to repeat for us his denunciation of the Federalist representative. Mr. Lyons, as you know, spent 4 months in prison last year for opposing the alien and sedition laws. Congressman Lyons, sir, what did Mr. Brown say that made you attack him?
I have been warning him, but the man is ignorant of my principles. He's an agent of the Federalist traitors.
But what did he say to you, sir?
He urged me to vote for Burr just now, for Burr, and of course I refused. And then he said to me, the scoundrel...
What did you say, sir?
Yes, sir, that's exactly what you are, sir, a scoundrel. What is it you want, Congressman Lyons, he said. Is it office? Is it money? Only say what you want, and you shall have it.
Mr. Brown, sir, have you any comment to make?
Yes, the gentleman from Vermont is a liar. Like all atheists are liars, and all the followers of Jefferson are atheists.
Now, just a moment.
They despise the truth as they despise God. And their hatred for God is equal to their hatred for those who own property.
Oh, what
nonsense. Why, these Democrats, these paupers, these vagabonds and outlaws, I say take away their vote, or they will pillage our towns and stain our soil with blood.
Ridiculous. Perfect.
Sir, I merely want to avoid bloodshed. For if Jefferson is elected, there is scarcely a possibility that we shall escape civil war.
But, Congressman, there are some who say that if Jefferson is not elected, there will be civil war.
Well, then let it come. It is bad, but less, far less than anarchy or slavery.
And I say that it is the Federalist Party that means to have a monarchy rather than a republic.
Better than rabble rule.
But the people will rise up, my dear sir. They will rise up and abolish the indignities of the Federalist Party.
By rise up, sir, do you mean revolution by force?
No, sir, I do not.
That's exactly what he means,
no,
sir.
No, I most certainly do not. My father-in-law was Ethan Allen. And when his Green Mountain boys wanted to storm the jail in which I was imprisoned in order to free me, I urged them to desist and go to the polls to vote for their freedom and mine. And as you see, they voted me out of jail and into Congress. And I shall vote, express the will of my fellow citizens, and continue to cast my ballot for Thomas Jefferson.
That is your privilege, sir, but it is also mine.
Thank you, Congressman Lyons and Congressman Brown. I have just been informed that Thomas Jefferson is expected at the home of Mr. James Madison. Douglas Edwards is there, so we take you to him now. Come in, Douglas Edwards.
Our hostess, Mrs. James Madison, Dolly Madison, as she's known by all, has informed us that Thomas Jefferson is on his way from his boarding house to dine here. We hope to persuade him to make a statement. To all of official Washington, this new house on F Street is more than the home of the liberal Virginian Democrat. It's a haven for tired statesmen. Most any afternoon at 4, you'll find the distinguished and talented of Washington and Europe enjoying the sumptuous dinners prepared by Dolly Madison, dinners lasting far into the night. This cordial Quakeress brings a touch of warm Virginia hospitality to Washington to thaw the February cold in the frozen mud of the Capitol. Her parties and dances and card games have won over the bitterest political foes of Jefferson. Dolly Madison is here with me now. She's wearing her famed white silk turban, draped with the large ostrich feathers. Margaret Baird Smith, who writes about Washington society, has said of Dolly Madison that she moves like a goddess and looks like a queen.
Yeah. That kind of flattery is reminiscent of my old friend Aaron Burr. Before Mr. Madison and I were married, Mr. Burr's extravagant flatteries and promises were meant to blind me to his true nature.
And what is your opinion of Mr. Burr now, Mrs. Madison?
His methods are the same in politics as they are in love, both deceiving. But let me tell you of some of our guests. They're all waiting for the outcome of the election. We have Joel Barlow, the poet of democracy. And there's a Bonaparte. And here is Mr. Merry, minister from Great Britain.
Your Excellency, are your hopes on Mr. Jefferson or Mr. Burr?
Well, His Majesty's government does not approve Mr. Jefferson's friendly views toward the Jacobins of France. My own opinion is that Mr. Jefferson has received the votes of a minority of free men and a majority of slaves.
And Mr. Burr, do you approve of him?
Mr. Burr, I do not want to seem too critical, but Mrs. Madison's food here is more like a harvest home supper than the entertainment of a statesman.
And I thought you were enjoying our hams, Ambassador.
Oh,
if our food is too democratic for you, but we have to sacrifice the delicacy of European taste for the less elegant but more liberal fashion of Virginia.
This is Noah Webster, Mr. Edwards.
He's a Federalist, but he enjoys the company of writers here. He's a writer himself, you know. What are you writing now, Noah?
I'm working on a compendious dictionary, my dear.
Good heavens, what sort of a dictionary is that?
A compendious, an adjective meaning briefly stated, succinct, concise, containing the substance in narrow compass, condensed, abridged, synonym, see terse.
I see. Well, as a Federalist, Mr. Webster, will you give us your compendious opinion on Mr. Jefferson and his supporters?
They are a rabble threatening the safety of the state. From my observations, republicanism is impossible unless the poorer classes are excluded from the vote. Witness how the mass voted for Jefferson. Witness how they are now corrupting law and order, descending upon the Capitol with pikes and muskets in their hands. Savages! Primitives. Too stupid, too abject in ignorance to think rightly, and too depraved to draw honest deductions.
You might do your dictionary a service, Noah, by consulting our vice president, Mr. Jefferson, for a more compendious definition of the people. For here he is now. Mr. Jefferson, this young man has asked if you'll make a statement to him on the election.
Well, now, I believed it my duty to be passive and silent during the present contest, lest some Federalist senators accuse me of being partial whilst I yet preside over the Senate. But what is it, sir, that you would like to ask me?
Mr. Jefferson, do you favor or oppose the threats of imminent violence raging about this election?
Whose violence? The violence of the Federalist Party to usurp the people's will? Or the violence of revolution that keeps governments in order to remind them of the rights of the governed?
I refer, Mr. Jefferson, to the actions of the militias of Virginia and Pennsylvania. Should that violence cause civil war or revolution, would you still hold favor with it?
Yes, if the will of the majority of the voters is denied by a cabal of selfish interests bent on the destruction of democracy.
But some argue, Mr. Jefferson, that the public good will be best served by keeping the peace and avoiding violence at all costs.
I know there are men who would prefer that I sacrifice my principles for the guarantee of safety. But I say this is a threat and is itself pregnant with violence. I believe in a jealous care of the right of election by the people. I believe in a mild and safe corrective of abuses which are lopped by the sword of revolution where peaceable remedies are unprovided. Even if force must be invoked, the vital principle of republics is the absolute acquiescence in the decisions of the majority.
Mr. Jefferson, earlier in this broadcast, Alexander Hamilton derided certain aspects of your platform, particularly your belief in democracy. Would you care to comment on that?
Mr. Hamilton has a perfect right to his opinions. He has no faith in democracy. I have. I believe in, and I was elected on these principles: equal and exact justice to all men, of whatever state or persuasion, religious or political. Peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none. The supremacy of the civil over the military authority, the diffusion of information, and the arraignment of all abuses at the bar of public reason. These principles form the bright constellation which has gone before us and guided our steps through an age of revolution and reformation. The wisdom of our sages and the blood of our heroes have been devoted to their attainment. They should be the creed of our political faith, the text of our civic instruction, the touchstone by which to try the services of those we trust. And should we wander from them in moments of error or alarm, let us hasten to retrace our steps and to regain the road which alone leads to peace, liberty, and safety.
Mr. Jefferson, those are things that can't be said too often, I think.
Well, that's very nice of you.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. We've had word that the 36th ballot has been taken in the House of Representatives, and the results are about to be announced, so back to the House and John Daly.
The 16 tellers are down there on the floor of the House checking the results of the 36th ballot now. And by the way, we tried to get Congressman Bayard of Delaware to tell us whether he would swing the single vote of his state from Mr. Burr to Mr. Jefferson, but he refuses to make any comment. Sitting up here in the gallery is Alexander Hamilton, watching the proceedings down on the floor, and the Federalist Party leader seems a weary and disillusioned man. Whether Mr. Jefferson or Mr. Burr should win this election down there on the floor, it is going to be Alexander Hamilton who is finally the loser. The congressmen in the House are silent. There's a sense of high expectancy. All eyes are on the tellers. They're comparing totals. Seem to be in agreement now as one of the tellers is writing the results on a piece of paper. But there is no indication, no sign on the face of the tellers as to whether or not the deadlock has been broken. A while ago, there were rumors that the Federalists... A teller has handed the paper now to Speaker Thomas Sedgwick. He glances at it. His face is impassive. There goes the gavel. Now down to the rostrum.
The results of the 36th ballot. Thomas Jefferson of Virginia, 10.
Yes!
It's Jefferson by 10 states. One more than is necessary. Jefferson has been elected. The members of the House of Representatives and the spectators in the galleries have broken into wild, jubilant cheering and applause. Jefferson picked up 2 votes on that last ballot, 1 more than was required, and Mr. Burr lost 2. I'm going to try to find out which state broke the tie and which cast the blank vote. Perhaps it was Delaware, maybe Maryland and Vermont, but we'll soon know. We'll know in a moment as soon as we...
Washington, February 17, 181.
We're going to have to detain...
The House of Representatives elects Thomas Jefferson...
You have been listening to The Election of Thomas Jefferson, another broadcast in the series You Are There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne. The Election of Thomas Jefferson was written by Joseph Liss. Walter Hamden was Thomas Jefferson, and the cast included Thomas Chalmers, Carl Swenson, Joan Wetmore, Bernard Lenro, Guy Sorrell, Ann Seymour, Eric Dressler, Walter Grisey, Doris Dalton, William Podmore, Charles Webster, Gavin Gordon, Bert Cowlin, and others. Next week...
April 9th, 1865, Lee and Grant at Appomattox. You are there.
Next this afternoon, great music comes your way from the New York Philharmonic Symphony. This evening, great comedy with Amos and Andy, now exclusively on CBS, and with Hollywood star comedian Eve Arden, your favorite schoolteacher, in Our Miss Brooks. This is CBS, where 99 million people gather every week, the Columbia Broadcasting System.